And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Welcome. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Hands-On Apologetics, Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Matuta, and we are going to journey together into yet another, dojo session of apologetics. I should have came up with something a little bit more clever and more well-refined than that. But anyway, welcome. We're going to have a lot of fun. It's always fun to explain, defend the faith, give us another reason to know and love Jesus more. And that's, for me, that's what apologetics is all about. It's not winning arguments, but it's clearing away these intellectual obstacles so that people can embrace the fullness of Christ in the church. And today is March 25th, which is the Feast of the Annunciation. And, you know, I wasn't planning on doing this, but I'm going to throw this in very quickly that, you know, why is it important for Scripture to include the Annunciation of Gabriel, giving the good news to Mary? Well, you know, after we do our housekeeping stuff, I'm going to talk a little bit about that and how the Old Testament kingdom makes it important. So we'll talk about that in a second. But anyway, coming up in the program, I need to do my housekeeping, is the one and only Mike Aquilina is going to join us. And we're going to talk about how Christianity introduced supernatural charity into the world. And that's a fascinating topic in and of itself, because we often think of the ancient world as being pretty much the same as it is today, when actually nothing could be further from the truth. We really sit on the precipice of a Mount Everest of development and Christian foundations that we kind of become blind to. So he's going to remind us of this wonderful gift Christ has given us through the church. We're also going to do our Finding the Fallacy, which is Moving the Goalpost Fallacy, and also meet the early church father for today, is Ignatius of Antioch. Great stuff coming ahead. In fact, if you want to chat with our guest, Mike Aquilina, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or you can always send an email to the dojo at questions@handsonapologetics.com. We love hearing from you. And we love questions as well. Fascinating stuff, folks. And it's time for the shout-outs for those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everyone. It's great to see everyone. Yes, I got the YouTube feed here, and great to see familiar names, and also the explosion of emojis. It's always a warm welcome. Well, hey, before we begin our exercise, let me explain a little bit about, you know, why is the Annunciation important? In my book, Making Sense of Mary, I talk a little bit about this, and this is something I discovered, is that in the Old Testament, with the dynasty of David, God promised David that he would always have his successor on the throne. And how does this dynastic succession work? Well, if you look closely at the biblical text, what happens is it's passed on, of course, through a son. But there's a problem, though, because unlike today, you know, with monogamy, the king didn't just have one queen. He actually had a bunch of queens, a harem, if you will, of queens. And so how could you determine who's the proper successor to the king? Well, if you look in 1 Kings, you find the first succession from David occurring through Bathsheba. And this is how succession worked. In order to be considered a lawful, you know, right to the dynastic throne, the king would give the promise to one of his queens that her son would sit on the throne. In this case, it would be King David tells Bathsheba that her son Solomon will sit on his throne. So that the woman has to receive the promise that her child will sit on the throne. And of course, when the king dies, or if there's a co-regency where maybe the king and his son kind of reign together for a little while, It basically goes from the king to promise one of his wives that her son will sit on the throne. When the king dies, the son takes the throne, and his mother becomes the queen mother, the Gibeah. And we talked about that in previous episodes. Now, there's a problem, though, because when Israel comes back out of the Babylonian captivity, there's no king, but guess what? There's no queen mother either. So the dynastic succession couldn't start up again because there wasn't a woman who received the promise from the king that her son would sit on the throne. Well, who's the true king of Israel? Well, we know in Scripture that God is the true king of Israel. And so what occurs in the Annunciation is that God, the true king of Israel, finds Mary and tells Mary through Gabriel that her son will sit on the throne of David, and therefore she becomes the woman of the promise. Jesus then is part of the dynasty of David, and guess what? Eventually, she becomes enthroned as the queen mother. So that's why I believe the Annunciation is important. That's why I think that the Gospels highlight it. It's because it shows that Jesus is a true son of David and has right to the throne. All right, so let's great stuff. Let's jump to our exercises. Finding a fallacy today is moving the goalpost. It's quite simple fallacy. Basically what it is when, especially in a debate, one opponent will say, I will believe if you can provide evidence X. Now, when evidence X is supplied, they move the goalpost and say, either say that X is not sufficient to prove the point, or they say, well, no, you need to actually show me Y instead of X, okay? This happens all the time, and it comes from this idea of making it more difficult to score a goal by moving the goalpost, right? And like I said, it happens in debate. It happens a lot in politics where, claims are made, and then when the claims turn out to be false, they move the goalpost, and they say, well, really, the more important issue is another different issue. So that's our finding of the fallacy for today, and let's go to meet the early church father, who is one of my all-time favorites, Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius of Antioch died roughly around AD 110. He was the bishop of Antioch. He was the second bishop after St. Evodius, who was the immediate successor of St. Peter. So he knew St. Peter. He lived in apostolic times. He's accounted as an apostolic father, and he's also a hero of John as well. During the reign of the Emperor Trajan, around 110 AD, he was sentenced to death and traveled to Rome to be eaten by a wild beast. On his way to his martyrdom, he pens 6 letters to different churches and 1 letter to a personal friend, Bishop Polycarp of Smyrna, who also is a disciple of the Apostle John. So we have 7 extant letters from Ignatius of Antioch, and I highly recommend it, folks. If you want something to read during Lent, go on the internet. You can access these. They're free of charge. Read the 7 letters that Ignatius writes. They're remarkable, and they're really kind of heart-rendering, because when you read these texts, you know that he's on his way to death, to certain death, and he exhorts Christians to stick by their guns, so to speak, and follow Christ, remain orthodox. And also, these 7 letters are incredibly valuable in Catholic apologetics. Why? Because Ignatius of Antioch mentions certain Catholic, distinctly Catholic doctrines in these letters. For example, he's known in the letter to Smyrna, he makes a couple of claims about the Eucharist, where it's clear that he understands that the Eucharist is the real body and blood, soul and divinity of Christ, that it contains the flesh that died for our sins and by the power of God was raised again. So he has a very concrete, very Catholic understanding of the Eucharist. He's also very clear in these letters about what's called a hierarchical or monarchical church. In other words, that there are priests, deacons, priests, and bishops in the church. Again, that's something that actually when these letters were being sorted through Protestant scholarships, a lot of Protestants claimed that, well, they must be spurious because he seems to have a very well-developed understanding of the church. You know, he seems to be very Catholic in a sense. However, you know, the genuineness of these letters have been vindicated by such Protestants as J.B. Lightfoot, Adolf von Harnack, Theodor Zahn, F.X. Funk, just to name a few. You know, so they're considered even by critical Protestant scholars as, now these things are authentic. So that's our early church father for today, St. Ignatius of Antioch, disciple of John, Bishop of Antioch. Remember, Antioch, by the way, was also the first place in Scripture where Christians were called Christians. Okay, so very, very early, important early church father. And like, again, like I said, if you haven't picked up any Lenten reading, highly recommend the letters of St. Ignatius of Antioch. Not only will it feed your soul, you know, because just the sincerity and, you know, the background to these letters, but they also would be very good evidence that you should be aware of about how certain Catholic doctrines are there, alive and well, in AD 110, if not earlier. Because he's not just making this up, folks. These are things that were widespread, widely held, even way, way back then. All right, coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to talk to Mike Aquilina about supernatural charity in the early church, how the Catholic Church had changed the ancient world. Don't want to miss it. You listen to Hands On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. Stay tuned, everyone. See you in a couple minutes.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. Well, like I mentioned before, it's strange how we think that ancient times are pretty much the same as modern times, and that this whole idea of charity and feeding the poor and doing good and loving our neighbors and loving our enemies are, it's part of the air we breathe. It's in our DNA, but actually not so much. And our guest is going to explain a little bit about how Christianity had introduced this into the ancient world. And our guest is the one and only Michael Aquilina. Mike is a popular author working in the area of church history, especially patristics, and that is the study of the early church fathers. He's the executive vice president and trustee of St. Paul's Center for Biblical Theology, which, of course, is a Roman Catholic research center based in Steubenville, Ohio. And he's also the author. You've seen him on EWTN, and, you know, I could go through all his accolades and so on, but then we wouldn't have time for the interview. So, Mike Aquilina, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Gary.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure to have you back. And Mike, you know, I have a question for you. How many books have you written?
You know, I don't know exactly. It's in the 50s, but it's in the mid-50s somewhere.
Wow. Wow, I believe it. It's hard to keep up with you.
Well, you know, Gary, writing books is pretty much all I do. So if it's all you do, you better do a lot of it or your kids starve.
That's a great point. Well, I mean, you've actually you've done a few books that touch on this area, and which I'd love to touch on is, you know, Christianity introduced something into humanity that just really wasn't there before. And that's this idea of this supernatural love. Maybe you can kind of trace the roots of, you know, what is this genesis and how did it change the world?
Well, you know, you bring up a really good point that Christianity really did effect a revolution in this area. Yeah. And it's something we take for granted today that that we have charitable institutions that look out for the poor, that we have a society that takes care of victims and protects the vulnerable. These are all things that are, you know, part of our idea of civilization today. But they don't just come naturally, and they did not come to the ancient world until Christianity introduced these ideas into the civilizational bloodstream, really. You know, think of the hospital, Gary. It's an institution that we consider today to be a mark of civilization. If you don't have a hospital, well, your city is really not civilized. It really doesn't count as a city if it doesn't have a hospital. Well, there were no hospitals until Christianity. There were no hospitals because hospitals really can't make money, and they expose people to a lot of danger. That's true even today, but it was true even more so in the ancient world when doctors really had no way of fighting contagion. So Christianity produced doctors who were willing to lay down their lives. Now, where did that come from? That came from Jesus. Jesus loved his own, loved them to the end, laid down his life for them, and the doctors who were Christian were willing to do that for the sake of other people. They did it for their fellow Christians, but they also did it for the pagans who were persecuting them, which is a remarkable thing.
Yeah, that is. In fact, I mean, even I don't know where I've read it before, but there are some sociologists that believe that the fact that Christians would stay in cities that were plagued and mm-hmm. care for the wounded, that those who survived converted to the faith because of that heroic charity, that they were willing to give up their lives to care for the sick.
Rodney Stark, the sociologist.
Yes,
sociologist
that's where I'm
thinking of, and he has a chapter in his book, The Rise of Christianity. Now, Rodney Stark is an agnostic, so he has no stake in our success. He has no stake in making us look good, and he really makes us look good because he draws the testimonies from the ancient world. And what we find is the Christian testimony is universal, that Christians were bound to take care of others. But also the pagan testimony is universal, that these Christians did the remarkable thing. And they took care of people who had the plague, had the illness. We have that from even as great an ancient physician among the pagans as Galen, who testifies to the courage of the Christians in taking care of their neighbors. And Cyprian, the bishop in Carthage, North Africa, during the plague of the mid-third century, told his people, he commanded them, you don't just take care of your own. It's no virtue if you just take care of your own, the people you love. You have to take care of the people you despise. You know, yes. these persecutors out there, the people who have killed members of your family, you have to pick them up out of the street when they're sick. You have to take them in, and you have to nurse them back to health. And of course, when people encountered that kind of love, they would convert. They would ask for baptism, and it accounted for at least some of the growth rate of the early church, which is pretty astronomical.
Yes. You know, when I was on Catholic Answers a few years ago, and I was talking about my book, Hostile Witnesses, a Jewish caller said, hold on a second, you know, Judaism always had this tradition of caring for others, and, you know, how can you say Christian charity was different? And my point was, yeah, actually, there's beautiful teaching about almsgiving. And, you know, so I agree with them. But yeah, the idea of loving your enemy is something very, very different. Was I correct?
Well, it is. And it kind of takes it to a new level. The other thing is that we really don't see any discontinuity between our tradition and the Jewish tradition in this matter. Right. We're just kind of continuing the revelation that they had received in the Old Testament. It's taken to a new level, a level of self-giving, giving one's entire life, laying down one's life for the sake of the other. What Christianity did was universalize it. No longer was this a teaching that applied to a certain people, but it was applied to the entire world. And we were taking it out and really taking the world by storm when you consider that the growth rate of the early church was 40% per decade, sustained for almost 300 years. 40% per decade.
That's amazing. Just exploded.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, you know, another thing too, and again, correct me or if you have a better analogy than this, is, you know, in the natural world, sometimes you will have cats who will go into a burning building to save their kittens, or you might have a dog go in to save even children or something like that. But you never find a deer running into a burning forest to save a lion. Or, they don't save their predators.
Right. And yet that's what Christians did.
Yes. Yeah. The thing is, I don't think people can really wrap their minds around a world where such a thing would be totally absurd to the average pagan. How would they see it?
Well, you know, I think they looked upon beggars as somehow deserving it. You know, that if you were on the outs, if you were down on your luck, if you were asking for money, that kind of thing, you probably did something to deserve it. And so there wasn't that kindness encouraged in a universal way. There was no idea of victims' rights. You know, it's funny, Gary, during World War II, we in the United States, we defeated our enemies in Europe, right? We defeated them. And what did we do? We gave them the Marshall Plan so that they could build back up and get back on their feet. Now, in the ancient world, that would have been seen as the stupidest thing you could do. These are your enemies. You're supposed to knock them down, keep them down, make sure they learn their lesson, make sure they never get up again and dare to confront you. But in our world, in our civilization, we say, no. You know, we defeated you for your own good, and now we're going to help you up to get back on your feet and get strong again. And then you look at the economies that we built up and all these industries that eventually competed with us in our own marketplaces. But we did it. We helped them up, and we saw a certain kinship between us and them. There wasn't that dividing wall, like you are a different kind of being. There was a universal kinship, a catholicity to our understanding of the world. And that was there even among the ancient Christians.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you know, when you were saying that, I was thinking Carthage, right?
Yeah.
Ancient Carthage, where not only did Rome defeat Carthage, but it strewed its fields with salt, so it never
right,
come
so
back.
So they could never grow again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, boy, it's so hard to wrap your mind around things like that. So the pagans kind of looked at it almost like a caste system, maybe, that some were fated for wealth and pleasure, and others were fated to poverty and, you know, and why change fate? Is that
accurate?
And
the lives of the gods reflected this. The lives of the gods were fairly, the gods were fairly indifferent to human suffering. They might do you a favor if you offered them a sacrifice, if you paid them proper honor, but, you know, it was very much a transaction, and they had no obligation to pay you any heed whatsoever. So the gods were really seen like the aristocrats, like the nobles. They lived in a world that was remote from your own. They didn't really care much for you. Now, it's interesting. They did not have charity, that kind of self-giving love, but they had a kind of giving that they called philanthropy. And Gary, if you've ever been to the city of Rome, you've seen the effects of Roman philanthropy. You see the Colosseum, which was built by the wealthy. You'll see the Pantheon, which was built by a wealthy donor. And you see the record of that donation in letters that are bigger than me, you know, huge letters at the top of these buildings, just to announce to the world forever that this is the donation of so-and-so. So it's not for the honor and glory of any god, really. It's for the honor and glory of the individual who made the donation. And there was philanthropy in the Roman world, in the Greek world, and it was seen as something necessary, a way of keeping the peace, keeping people satisfied. What did you need to keep the peace? Well, people had to have bread and circuses. You had to keep their bellies full, and you had to keep them distracted with entertainment. And it was a philanthropic effort to provide that. But again, it was for the honor and glory of the individual donor, not for the honor and glory of God. We don't know the donors who built the first Christian churches, and we never will, because they just gave. And we don't know the donors who built the first hospitals, because they just gave, and they probably gave their lives in these epidemics.
Beautiful. Well, boy, I'm sure glad those days are behind us, Mike.
not so fast there. I think we're slipping back into them, Gary, because it seems to me that as we lose our fervor for the faith, we also lose our instinct for charity.
Yeah, so we're talking to Michael Aquilina about supernatural charity in early church. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. you can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Michael Aquilina about the early church and how Christ and the church introduced something new into the ancient world, namely the supernatural charity. And Mike, you know, to begin this section, I'd like to just really quick quote from a fellow named Lucian of Samosata in his Death of Peregrinus. It says, "The Christians you know worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account." Then he continues, "You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains their contempt for death and voluntary self-devotion, which is so common among them. And then it was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they're all brothers from the moment in which they're converted and deny the gods of grace and worship a crucified sage and live after his law. All this is done quite on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods alike, regarding them merely as common property." Any thoughts?
It sounds pretty accurate, and it sounds like the way it had to be. And of course, that's a non-Christian testimony. You know, someone looking at the Christians and trying to explain how they do the things they do, and as you point out, because you invoke these hostile witnesses, we have abundant testimony from the ancient world, from people who opposed Christianity, that they still had to admire the Christians for making possible what had been impossible before. That's true even up until our own time, really. In my own city, I live in Pittsburgh, and the citizens of Pittsburgh tried again and again to found a hospital here. But what would happen? They'd get it started, they'd hire people, they'd bring in doctors, and as soon as an epidemic hit town, this was in the 19th century, as soon as an epidemic hit town, what would happen? All the doctors would leave. Why? They didn't want to get exposed to the disease. They didn't want to catch the disease and give it to their family. And you can't blame them for feeling that way. That's the way it was in the ancient world. The doctors would be the first to leave town. In Pittsburgh, the way we finally got a hospital started was that the Bishop of Pittsburgh, the Catholic Bishop of Pittsburgh, brought in the Sisters of Mercy from Ireland. And they founded a hospital, Mercy Hospital, here in Pittsburgh. They staffed the hospital, and they stayed. They stayed with their patients even through the epidemic, even if it meant that the sisters were going to get cholera themselves. And that's how we were able to sustain a hospital here. We got an anti-Catholic mayor in the 1840s, and he tried to shut the place down. And it's interesting the kind of pushback he got from Protestant editorialists who said, "Look, this is where you have to draw the line in your anti-Catholicism, because we have not succeeded in getting a hospital started, but these Catholics have." We see this instinct. It's a Catholic instinct in every age, that there's an instinct towards self-giving, towards sharing. If you have something, well, then you share it with others, and it continues to our own day.
Yeah, wow, that's fascinating. So there's kind of there's something in the Catholic genius about supernatural charity that gives us this staying power and also this evangelization power as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you read the ancient testimonies from the Christian side, and they talk about where they got it. implicit in their understanding is that they got it at Mass. A couple of my favorite passages from early Christianity are from Justin Martyr, who's writing around 150 A.D., and from Tertullian, who's writing just a little bit later. Now, Justin's in Rome, and Tertullian's in North Africa, and they both talk about the typical kindness of Christians, and they do it in an interesting way. They both do it in the context of a description of the Holy Mass. You know, Justin is talking about what happens at Mass, and he talks about how there's a collection at every Mass, and the collection is deposited with the pastor, the president, he calls him, and he gives that as relief to orphans and widows and those who, through sickness or any other cause, are in want, and those who are in chains, and the strangers sojourning among us, and in a word, takes care of all who are in need. So what Justin is doing there is he's describing all of the vulnerable populations of the city of Rome, all of the people who would have been off the radar of ordinary folks, and especially of the elites. They were very much on the radar of the Christians, and they were given special treatment by the Christians. Tertullian does the same thing, and he says that we have this collection we take up during Mass. And it's at the offertory. Both of them describe it as part of the offering there. But what do they do with it? Tertullian says, hey, we don't spend ours on parties and drinking binges and feasts, but we support and bury poor people. We supply the wants of orphans and elderly people who are homebound, those who have suffered shipwreck, and those who have been condemned to work in the mines or banished to the islands or shut up in prisons. It is such deeds of noble love, he says, that lead many to put a brand upon us and say, see how they love one another. You know, Christians wore charity like a brand on their bodies. That's how a master would identify his slaves, with a brand, right? Or a tattoo. Well, Christians, for Christians, the distinguishing mark was charity. It's the way they lived, that distinctive way they lived. And you have all of the early Christians invoking this whenever they wrote about themselves, even to their enemies. So if their enemies could look at them and say, that's not true, you know, they wouldn't have written it. If the enemies were able to easily deny it. But no, the enemies had to acknowledge it, just like the Emperor Julian did when he said, see that the Christians provide even for our poor. Everyone knows that we neglect our poor. And Julian was trying to re-paganize the empire. Well, he failed because the Christians continued.
Yeah, that was shocking to me when I was reading that Julian the Apostate, emperor who tried to save paganism that was falling into disrepair, and he recognized, he actually saw Christian charity as a threat, that the pagan church needs to reform itself, and, you know, otherwise these Christians are going to take over.
Yeah, Julian's kind of a funny character because he's, you know, we talked before about how the church grew at a rate of 40% per decade. Well, Julian saw that there was no way of beating Christianity, you know, on the received terms here. So what he did was he tried to redesign Roman religion, traditional Roman religion, so that it looked like the Catholic Church, only with the old Roman gods. So he appointed bishops and priests and deacons, people in those roles in his pagan church, and he established institutional charities, just as the church had, you know, orphanages and hospitals and that sort of thing. He tried to do this, and he tried to put his priests in charge of it. Well, the funny thing is that it just could not work because the pagan priests were not accustomed to living this way. They were just aristocrats. They had no special training in virtue or formation, what we consider priestly formation. It's just their inherited office, what they got by being born into a certain family. And they didn't take to it too well. And, of course, Julian's entire project just crashed and burned. He only reigned for 3 years. He was killed in battle, and then everything went back to the way it was before, with Christianity growing at its astonishing rate.
Yeah, he even had government subsidies for the pagan temples to hand out food and wine and wheat, I think it was, to the poor.
Yes, and he instructs the priests on how to do it in imitation of the Christians. But again, their heart wasn't in it. You can't make people want to do this by legislating it.
Yes.
You know, you can't make a law that tells people to be virtuous. The Christians were doing all of this voluntarily. Both Justin and Tertullian emphasized that fact, that the money that goes into the collection plate is not coerced, it's not commanded, it's voluntary. And there's a lot to that. The Christians are giving of themselves voluntarily in imitation of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and it's also a salvation issue. You know, when you fed the hungry, you fed me. You know,
yes, that great passage from late in St. Matthew's Gospel, where our Lord tells people to find him in the sick, in the imprisoned, and in the dying. It remains in your memory, and it prods you along. You know, it does for me as well.
Yeah, and there's no pagan equivalent to that.
We see it in Christian preaching from the earliest years. There's a great passage in Clement of Rome, who's writing in the first century. Now, Clement is a disciple of Saints Peter and Paul. He knew the apostles. And what does he tell people? He tells them, the strong are not to ignore the weak, and the weak are to respect the strong. Rich men should provide for the poor, and the poor should thank God for giving them somebody to supply their wants. So he's really talking about a community that's formed in love and that gives supplies the needs of others.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Mike, when I was reading that with Julian the Apostate, and how he was trying, and actually it was through your book, how you pointed out how he was trying to get the pagan priest to act like Christian priest. I was thinking, that's really the death blow, isn't it? Can you imagine if Pepsi-Cola advertised that we're just like Coke? You know, no one would buy it.
Right. Now, Julian was kind of a crafty guy, because he knew that if he tried to suppress the church in an overt way and in a violent way, he'd just make martyrs. And he knew enough history to know that Christianity thrives on the blood of the martyrs, that if he made martyrs, he would lose the war. And so he tried hard not to kill people, but rather to remove Christians from the public square, get them out of the public view, make stringent requirements that would eliminate all Christians from the practice of law and education by requiring the people in those fields to sacrifice to the gods, and all the Christians would leave. And that was really Julian's project. And again, he failed, because he could not get people excited about paganism.
Yeah, very good. Talking to Michael Aquilina about supernatural charity. Stay tuned, everyone.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics, and we are talking with the one, the only Michael Aquilina about how Christianity had introduced something new into the world. And this is just one of several things that the Catholic Church has born into the world, is this supernatural love. And, you know, Mike, before we went to the break, you mentioned about how Julian the Apostate had this program of disenfranchising teachers and pushing Christians out of the public square. And I was going to finish that segment the same way I finished the first one. Boy, I'm glad things have changed.
No, you know, I think that Julian really is. I don't think they're consciously modeling themselves after him, but secularists are really following the same program that Julian proposed in the late 4th century. I think that they have the same idea, is to move Christianity out of the public square, out of the mainstream, relegate us to a ghetto where we can have what they call, you know, freedom of worship, but not really freedom to practice our religion among others. But you know, I really don't think that's going to work. I have my serious doubts that the wider culture will be able to sustain its philanthropic institutions without that impulse of supernatural charity. I just don't think that hospitals and healthcare are sustainable apart from that vocational sense that I am doing this, I'm giving my entire life for this purpose, and I am doing this for God. I have the same doubts about education. What made so much an education great in this country is that not only in the Catholic schools, but even in the public schools, people gave their entire lives to the task of teaching young people. It was pretty common, even at the university level, not to marry because you wanted to give yourself entirely to the task of teaching others. Without that kind of selflessness, I think that education and medicine and so many other things that we value just fall into a kind of cynicism, and they wither and they disappear. That there's a real danger of that, I think, Gary, and the only way out is for us to remain faithful and to try to preserve our place in these institutions as best we can, or create the institutions ourselves. Find a way that we can do medicine on our own terms rather than having the terms dictated by our enemies.
Yeah, very good. I think you can kind of see a restricting going on where the focus is either on profits or it's on utility, you know, where schools are not focusing only on, you know, getting good jobs, getting certain skills, or hospitals about the bottom line being profitable. And so, yeah, I think you can kind of see that restrictions kind of going on right now.
Yeah, I think that the idea of giving oneself is appealing at a fundamental level. And I think that people when they encounter it, when they see a Mother Teresa of Calcutta, when they see somebody who has given herself entirely or himself entirely, they're inspired by that, and they say, I want the kind of joy that that person has. I want the kind of happiness that person has. And it's interesting, as we get into the 4th century and the 5th century, we find that many of the wealthiest people began to convert to Christianity and give their entire family fortune over to these institutions, to the hospitals and to the churches. It's as if there was a conversion of Bill Gates and Taylor Swift and all of these other great and wealthy celebrities who just gave their fortunes over to the good of others. This happened in the 4th century and the 5th century. It's well documented. Peter Brown just wrote 2 books about it. The wealthiest people were inspired by the self-giving of Jesus, and they chose to follow him that way and to give everything they had for the good of others.
Yeah, very good. And, and part of that is through monastic orders. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the monastic orders, for example, in England, where you have that beautiful symbiosis of benefactors giving money to feed the poor, and the poor in exchange pray for the benefactors.
Yes. Oh, it's a beautiful economy. And that's what Clement of Rome was describing in his letter during the first century.
Yeah.
This interdependence we have. It's not just the poor who are dependent upon the rich. It's the rich who are dependent on the prayers of the poor. God made it that way. That's our ecosystem. He said it's not good for the man to be alone, so he made us to live in society so that we would depend upon one another. If you're so wealthy then you think you're independent, you got another thing coming. You know, you are dependent on the prayers of others, on the kindness of others, on the intercession of others. So this is the way it was in the early church, and that was recognized. It's interesting, Gary, you mentioned the monastic orders, the early monasteries that were founded during these centuries, and many of the wealthy, after giving their fortunes away, retired to these monasteries. That was true of Paulinus of Nola and his wife. It was true of many of those great donors of the 4th century, 5th century, and 6th century. But also, we find something interesting happening, that the monasteries themselves become hospitals, because they take in any refugee. They take in anyone who's sick, anyone who's dying, anyone who's been robbed. Travelers were very vulnerable during that time. So the monasteries became hospitals. They became that kind of institution that took in all comers. And eventually, you have a legal church where Basil the Great could construct a monastery so vast that it was like a new city, and it had an orphanage, and it had a soup kitchen, and it had a hospice in it. It had a hospital. It had a trade school so that people could be raised up out of begging, and so on. This all came out of that monastic culture, but the monastic culture itself was being fed by the very wealthy in the city who wanted to see this thrive and who were doing their own kind of self-giving.
Yeah. Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah. And then, in England, you have Henry VIII, who suppresses the monastic orders, the churches.
Yeah.
He shuts down the monasteries. And then England
and when
has
he died,
a problem.
His last words were monks, monks, monks.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah,
he was haunted by that all his life, I believe.
Wow. I didn't know that. But that's fascinating, because what happened was, now you had a bunch of the poor had no one to supply them with food. And so that's when they started passing a poor tax to tax Anglican churches and use that money to feed the poor, which eventually becomes the modern welfare state.
Yes, yes. And again, this is something that cannot be legislated. Cannot legislate virtue. You know, it did not work with Julian the Apostate, and I don't think it's going to work very well in our own time. We have to motivate Christians to live like Christians and motivate more people to become Christian so that we'll have the kind of world that our Lord talked about.
Yeah. You know, one thing that struck me with looking back at, the paragraph I just read, I can't think of the name. But he says that the Christians, yes, Lucius, the Christians have this voluntary self-devotion, you know, that they love one another. And when you go to your average parish, you don't see that. How can we bring that back to our parishes, this community of love?
Well, I think you do. You do see it at a certain level. You know, if you go to a Sunday Mass, you're in there with a crowd of people. Here comes everybody. There are people with all different levels of motivation, and I'm glad. I'm glad that people don't stop going to Mass, even if their devotion wanes, or even if they start to waver in their belief or in their morals. Even they keep going to Mass, and that's a beautiful thing. If you go to weekday Masses, you see that kind of care. You know, it's interesting. I go to Mass at my parish here. I look around. I see the people who are keeping our town running because they're the volunteers for Meals on Wheels, because they're the volunteers for everything in our town. They're keeping everything going, and they love one another. Just today, one of our regulars, we got the announcement during Mass that one of our regulars at the noon Mass died. And so everybody just went over to the widow immediately after Mass and comforted her and gave her that kind of love. You don't always see it on Sunday. Try going to a weekday Mass or two, and I think you'll see it in action.
Beautiful. Yeah, very good. Well, Mike, if someone who wanted to read more on this, what books could you recommend that you've written on this subject?
Well, with Jim Papandrea, I wrote a book called How Christianity Saved Civilization. And of course, it goes into great detail about these charitable the charitable outreach of the early church. I'd also recommend my book, The Healing Imperative, which is a history of the invention of healthcare as we know it by the Christians of the earliest centuries. So those are the two books that immediately come to mind. But really, all of my books about the early church at least touch on this.
Yeah, and I recommend all your works, all 50 plus books that you've authored. Is there a website people can go to?
Yes, my website is fathersofthechurch.com. Fathersofthechurch.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mike. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks for having me on again, Gary.
All right. God bless. That was Mike Aquilina, folks. I highly recommend everything he writes, especially if you love the early church. And I tell you, a lot of eye-opening insights, especially in his work on supernatural charity and about a half dozen other revolutions that the church has brought to the world that's made the world better. So check it out, everybody. Tomorrow, we're going to have Carl Keating, the founder of Catholic Answers, come join us. We're going to talk about, actually, it's going to be a continuing monthly series. We're going to talk about books that every apologist needs to read. And we're going to talk about a very famous written debate between Father Ronald Knox and Arnold Lund called Anglican Difficulties. So I'm looking forward to that. Also, Wednesday, Ken Hensley. Thursday, Joseph Pierce. And Friday, Father Patrick Collins is actually coming in the dojo here and be with me to talk about exorcisms and apologetics. Is there any crossover? Curiously enough, there is. You don't want to miss it. All right, it's time for me to turn off the lights here at the dojo, shut down the Midwest Command Center. Coming up next, we have the show that started it all, the Terry and Jesse Show. High-impact talk radio coming at you. And, I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I appreciate your support. And please keep Virgin Most Powerful Radio in your prayers. Tell us to your friends. Share us with your friends. Like us on social media. Pass the word around. And also, we thank you in advance for any generous donations that you give us. Help us pay our electric bills. I'm Gary Machuda signing off. Have a wonderful and blessed day. Take care. And God bless. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.